is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
What is going on with Rex Heuermann, the man accused of being the Gilgo Beach killer, the Long Island serial killer? Well, that's what we're here today to break down, because it's slow going, and it is still slow going, and will likely be slow going for the foreseeable future. But how about an update? How about a little look-see behind the curtain? There's something deeply unnerving about silence when it is this heavy. Kind of silent, the silence that hangs over a courtroom that hasn't even yet opened. A case that hasn't gone to trial. And a shoreline that still holds secrets. That's where we are with Rex Heuermann right now, the alleged Long Island serial killer, Gilgo Beach killer, the man who for over 2 years now has been both nowhere and yet everywhere at once, locked up, untried, unconvicted, yet already a living ghost haunting the justice system that caught him. People keep asking, why is this taking so long? Why are we still waiting? Isn't the evidence overwhelming? Don't they have DNA, burner phones, surveillance, the guy's house full of trophies? What could possibly take this long? The truth is, everything. Everything takes this long when the stakes are this high. Every sample, every hair, every ruling has to be handled as if the entire credibility of the American justice system depends on it. Because in this case, it kind of does. To the families, the waiting feels like more torture, more than they've already endured with a system that's covered up investigating this case for decades. Cases, really. They've already waited 15 years for an arrest. Now they wait again while the machine of justice creaks and sputters forward one motion at a time. But underneath that silence, there's a war going on, a war between silence and skepticism, between the state's need to convict and the defense's right to tear apart every inch of that process until there is nothing left but dust. The big turning point came last September. Two rulings. Both seismic. The first allowed prosecutors to use something new, something almost science fiction, DNA evidence pulled from rootless hair. That's right, no follicle, no traditional DNA source, just a strand. For decades, investigators had boxes of hair evidence that they couldn't use because there wasn't enough genetic material to test. But with new whole genome sequencing technology, they can now extract nuclear DNA, the gold standard, from what was once considered useless. That's how they tied Heuermann to multiple victims. The lab that did the work, Astera Forensics, claims the method is revolutionary. The defense calls it junk science with good marketing, basically. And that's where the real battle started. Not in the court of public opinion, but inside the lab reports. When the judge ruled that this DNA could be admitted, people thought, that's it. The trial's about to start. No. That ruling didn't close a door. It opened every other one. Because once a court allows a new forensic technology, every single line of its processing becomes fair game. The defense now wants the raw sequencing data, the software code used to process it, the error margins, the statistical models, the accreditation paperwork. They're demanding to know whether Astera was even licensed by New York State when the analysis happened. They filed for independent experts to run their own tests, and every one of those requests spawned a new round of hearings. So that happened too. And then that's just the science portion of this, layered on top of the fact that this trial isn't for one murder or two, seven victims spanning nearly 20 years. The prosecution wanted them all tied together, arguing the pattern is the proof, the method, the geography, the timeline, the disposal. The defense wanted them separated because seven murders in front of one jury. It's not a trial, it's a firing squad. But the judge sided with the state. One trial, seven counts. The decision alone adds months to the prep, because when you merge that many cases, you don't simply You don't simplify, you multiply. You're going to be arguing seven deaths in one case. Seven sets of evidence, seven chains of custody, seven autopsies, seven different crime scenes. And all of it has to be cataloged, authenticated, and bulletproof. Because if you get one that's off or not quite right, may tumble the rest of the house of cards, even if those pieces of the deck are solid. So when people say, why are we waiting? It's because the legal system is still building the floor this trial will stand on, and no one wants to see it collapse halfway through. Let's talk about the DNA in that fight, because it's not going away anytime soon. The technology at the center of the whole genome sequencing from rootless hairs is, it's new. It's so new that there isn't a century of case law to back it up, but that's how any sort of new technology is. It has to start somewhere. Just because it's new doesn't mean it's bad. It's the same kind of leap that once introduced fingerprinting. Oh, that's high-tech fingerprints. Trust me, look back in history. You will find that being argued as, well, we can't trust that. No, can we? Blood typing, mitochondrial DNA. Every time science pushes forward, the law takes years to catch up. Not because it can't, but because defense attorneys see it as an open window to be like, see, it's not accurate. It's new. It's can't. When you got nothing to stand on, you stand on that sort of shit. The courts have to decide, is this science ready for prime time, or is it going to create false certainty in the jury's mind? Both sides have pandering experts. They do. Arguing about how it all works together. Whether the human genome is unique enough for conclusive identification from degraded samples, and how much contamination could happen over 30 years in an evidence locker, and all sorts of other scientific things that blow you and me away and we really truly don't understand. The defense isn't stupid. They know that they can't uninvent science. What they can do is sow doubt. They can point to software glitches. They can point to things where, oh, the software was updated while we were doing this. They can question whether a single mislabeled vial could have transferred a trace amount of DNA. They can come up with anything. Did you wash your hands? Contamination. I mean, there's so many. They're going to look for anything and everything they possibly can. That's what a defense attorney does. And if they can make the jury feel even a sliver of uncertainty, that's what they're going to rely on for reasonable doubt. And if that happens, that can be a big deal. The judge is letting all of the new DNA evidence in, which was a big thing. But that did take quite a bit of time and quite a bit of posturing back and forth before that decision was made. So while we may not have this trial beginning in the purest of senses of, oh, we're all in the courtroom, the jury's there. Anyone who follows cases knows that a good 80 to 90% of the case is already litigated before the jury even is chosen. And that's what's been going on the past several years. That's what's been going on this year. Prosecutors are moving slowly, painfully slowly, to make sure that there's no errors. Because you don't want to have to do it all over again. Every exhibit has to be certified, every chain of custody notarized, every technician vetted. They're not just prosecuting Huerman. They're writing the precedent for how New York courts will treat advanced DNA for the next 50 years. And everybody knows it. Meanwhile, defense attorneys are building their appeal record before the trial even starts. Every time they file a motion, they're preserving an argument for later. The DNA was unvalidated. The judge erred in consolidation. Evidence was prejudicial. They're laying breadcrumbs for appellate courts. So they want everything to move in slow motion. Every delay benefits the defense because every delay erodes memory. Delay tests patience. Delay makes witnesses disappear. It makes jurors forget. It makes the public stop caring. And let's talk about the discovery. That black hole of time that devours every major case. This isn't just new evidence. This is evidence collected before digital forensics existed. Before cell tower triangulation was even a thing. before DNA databases. They're pulling old handwritten notes out of evidence lockers, scanning them, authenticating signatures, identifying officers who've long since retired or died. Phone records from carriers that don't exist anymore. Tower data maps that have to be reconstructed from FCC archives. Even the physical evidence, burlap, hair, bone fragments, have to be reanalyzed with modern methods, which means redocumenting the chain of custody from the 90s through today. That's a long bit of time. I know it doesn't feel like it. It's a long bit of time. That's dozens of pages per item. Multiply that by hundreds of items across seven victims, and you start to see the scale. Add to that, the Suffolk County DA's office isn't just fighting for a conviction. They're fighting for redemption. For years, that department was dodged by accusations of incompetence and corruption through the original Gilgo investigation. Leads ignored, evidence misplaced, political interference. When Hierman was arrested, it was their shot at salvation, proof that they could fix the mistakes of the past. That's why this prosecution is cautious. They know if they blow it, it won't just be a lost case. It'll be the end of the public's faith in them. And then there's the money. The county had to unlock over $13 million in frozen funds just to keep the case moving. For lab work, expert witnesses, digital restoration. You don't spend that kind of money without paperwork. Every invoice, every reset, retest, every motion gets routed through administrative approval. The machinery of bureaucracy moves as slowly as justice itself. The irony is brutal. The more carefully they try to ensure justice, the longer it will take. Behind the scenes, you've got the revolving door of specialists, forensic anthropologists, data analysts, DNA statisticians, even behavioral experts reconstructing timelines. None of them are full-time. They come in on contract. Scheduling alone adds months. Some have to testify remotely. Others are prepping for other cases. The DA's office has to juggle expert availability with courtroom calendars and discovery deadlines. So what looks like nothing's happening is actually hundreds of moving parts trying to align. What about Hierman himself? He's sitting in pretrial detention, isolated, monitored, but not yet convicted. Forensic psychologists have written about what happens to men like him during this kind of wait. The narcissism tends to turn inward. They control. And that control that they once exercised over the world, it collapses, and they start obsessing over procedural minutes and the minutiae of it because it's the only area where they still have influence. They micromanage their defense, obsess over filings, dictate strategy, nitpick discovery. For a man accused of controlling, torturing, and disposing of victims, the ultimate punishment right now is his total lack of control. He's living in a cage, made of his own procedural delays. Meanwhile, the families, they're living through a kind of hell that doesn't end. The initial arrest gave them hope. Finally, someone would answer for what happened. Now they sit through endless hearings about chain of custody and software validation, while the faces of their daughters, sisters, and mothers fade into case numbers. They watch the man accused of killing them sit in court with a blank face while lawyers debate code snippets. It's not justice yet. It's purgatory. And purgatory by design doesn't move quickly. What comes next isn't glamorous. The court will spend months deciding what evidence the jury can hear, what experts can testify, how the jury will be instructed to consider each victim separately. They'll argue over whether jurors should remain anonymous, whether they can be sequestered, whether the trial can even happen in Suffolk County without bias. And then comes voir dire, the painstaking process of selecting a jury that hasn't already made up its mind. That alone could take months. And once they're seated, the trial itself could stretch half a year. Think about that. A trial so massive it'll need a courtroom remodeled just to hold the evidence tables. And after the verdict, appeals, years of them. Even if Hierman is convicted on all counts, his lawyers will challenge every piece of forensic evidence, every ruling on consolidation, every expert witness. They'll argue ineffective assistance, improper venue, you name it. That's why prosecutors are so meticulous right now. They're not just trying to win. They're trying to make sure the win survives. This isn't the story of a system asleep. It's a story of a system that's terrified of itself. Terrified of making the same mistake that led serial killers slip through the cracks in the past. Terrified of creating new precedent that could backfire. Terrified of rushing a process that can't afford to break. So it moves one inch at a time. Bleeding clock, but saving face. What people forget is that justice and closure are not synonyms. Justice is a process. Closure is a feeling. The first can take decades. The second sometimes never comes. And in the gap between them, that's where the families live. That's where the public waits. That's where monsters like Rex Heerman allegedly sit, untried, unconvicted, but never truly free again. If you zoom out, this isn't just about the man's crimes. It's about how the American legal system handles evil in the modern age. With science that's evolving faster than law, with public outrage that burns hotter than due process can handle, with victims whose stories get buried under the weight of bureaucracy. The Gilgo Beach murders have always been about time. How long the victims lay undiscovered, how long it took to find a suspect, and how long it will take to prove guilt. Time is a real weapon in this case. It's been weaponized by both sides. So when you ask, why are we still waiting? It's because the case is a minefield. The state is trying to navigate it without stepping on a single procedural explosive. And if they succeed, they'll not only convict a man who terrorized women for decades, they'll also redefine how forensic science enters the courtroom in this country. The beach will always be quiet. The wind will always blow through that stretch of sand where they found those remains. That silence, that's a soundtrack to the waiting. But beneath it, the gears are still turning. Every motion, every argument, every reset is another rotation in a machine that's grinding towards the truth, however slowly. Because there isn't a pause. It's pressure. The kind that either cracks the system or proves it still works. And if it ever finally reaches trial, the noise that breaks that silence, the sound of testimony, evidence, and verdict will echo longer than any scream Rex Heerman ever silenced. That's why we wait. Not because justice forgot, but because justice can't afford to make another mistake. Your thoughts on this case in the comment section on YouTube. If you're not already there, if you're listening to us on the podcast platforms, thank you. Be sure to hit subscribe and then search Hidden Killers with Tony Brewski and press subscribe there on YouTube or over on podcast platforms or on social media or everywhere you want to be. So please hit subscribe and let us know your thoughts. Until next time, my name is Tony Brewski. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Brewski and the Hidden Killers podcast.